my heart.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at kuci.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
Good morning and welcome to this March 19th, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available to you via podcast. I will tell you more about that later in the show. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, we're here with authors to talk about craft, content, and writing. Today, we're going to talk a lot of poetry and novel writing. I'm joined this morning by Laura Kosiski. And coming up in the second half hour, Michael Miller will be here to discuss his poetry collection, The First Thing Mastered. Laura Kosiski was raised in Grand Rapids, Michigan. She is the recipient of the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry in 2012. She has published 8 novels, 2 of which have been made into feature films, The Life Before Her Eyes and Suspicious River, and 8 books of poetry, most recently Space in Chains. She has received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, as well as several pushcart prizes and numerous poetry awards. Her writing has appeared in Best American Poetry, The Kenyon Review, Harper's, The New Republic. She is the Alan Seeger Collegiate Professor of English and Language and Literature at the University of Michigan. Her latest novel, Mind of Winter, forthcoming at the end of this month, is what we are talking about this morning. Laura, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you on. This was terrifying. I'm a huge lover of psychological thrillers, and this was fantastic. So I'm going to give you a chance to introduce the novel, sort of where it came from in your head, and talk a little bit about it.
Well, it came from my head. truly, I mean, it sounds like something someone would make up about writing a novel, but I really woke up one morning with the idea of the novel in my head, which the protagonist wakes up one morning with an idea that she can't get out of her head. So the two things went together. The writer, myself, was having such an experience as I was writing about a woman having an experience like this. And, you know, it's kind of synthesizes of thoughts that I've had and things that have happened to me over the years that I don't know that I didn't really know that I was thinking about in a way that would ever evolve into a novel, but then, which did, but things having to do with, with motherhood and genetics and history and nature versus nurture. And so that's, I woke up and wrote the first paragraph of the novel and came back to it later in the day and just kept writing until I had already conceived of the end before I had started it. So it was one of my easier novels to write.
I was going to say, this is every novelist's dream. No one.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't happen to me very often either. One other time I had such flow, but otherwise it's usually a lot of outlining and revised. Well, I mean, I revised it quite a bit, but not for order or, major plot developments or anything like that. That just kind of, it was sort of a piece.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, was whether the plot came to you and you still had to figure out what the story meant, what it was about. So was it a fully formed storyline that you then had to go back and look at and say, okay, what does this mean? And what are the issues that I'm really grappling with?
Well, it's not so much a matter of going back and looking at it, but of figuring that out every day during the writing process. I mean, a lot of that takes place while I'm actually writing, but then a lot of that takes place during the time period that I'm drafting a novel. I'll be thinking about it while I'm cooking dinner or driving or reading other things. So it's not that I wrote a whole draft and then went back and thought, what does this mean? But just that it's something that I'm thinking about every day as I'm writing. It becomes clearer during the writing. Then, of course, when you revise, you go back and having finished it with new eyes, go back and revise for things that you discovered along the way. But mostly it was a matter of discovering it along the way.
I was thinking about, you know, through all the collections of poetry that you've written and through the 8 novels, if you can look across the arc of all of your work, the novels, poetry is a different animal, so maybe we'll set that aside, but and kind of see your areas of concern as a writer, areas of concern as woman, mother, human being, and whether you see themes across these 8 novels that keep recurring to you.
Well, I definitely do. I mean, I think probably someone else looking at it could tell me better than I can see it myself. But I do know, looking back, that I think all the plots of my novels, and then I think in some way just my whole impulse for writing poetry is, people, consciousnesses grappling with things they've kept secret from themselves, or facts about their lives or their existences that are just at the level of the subconscious, mm-hmm. and the plot, or the events of a novel reveal a truth that's been there from the beginning.
Right, right. What was, as you were working through this, and I was, kind of uncoding it for myself. Was there a process of kind of uncoding the mysteries of this for you, in terms of what you were really trying to get at? Was it obvious to you all the way along what you were trying to get at, or were there, kind of this Russian nesting doll mysteries that kind of kept revealing itself to you the longer you wrote it?
Definitely the latter, the rebel, kind of a daily, because I worked on the novel every day, a daily revelation of what was going on. And a lot of times it's not even so much in events that I think about that or figure that out, but in details, just domestic details, what people are eating, what they're, cleaning, the landscape and the weather and these sorts of things. Are where I go to figure out what the second layer of the novel, what the subtext is.
Right, right, right. I don't want to give too much away with the novel. It's hard not to give too much away without, being able to talk about it and not say too much. But the characters in here are wonderful. It takes place in a single day with a lot of flashbacks, and it's told primarily from one character's point of view. But there are only 2 characters in the house, so you have a lot of characters who are off stage. And I want to talk a little bit about these 2 main characters, how much character work you did on them, if you kept notebooks on them, if you had little scrapbooks that kind of told you who these people were, and how much you knew about the characters off stage, who didn't have as much page time, but if you had developed sort of worlds for them in your head as well, and how much you knew about them.
Well, I always have a notebook going, and I do, flesh out characters that way and details of their lives that won't necessarily make it into the novel. Sometimes that with other novels, it's been much more specific. I have much more specific grappling and painting portraits. With this one, I felt, I don't know, I just really did sort of feel that I had a whole picture from the very beginning. So there was a little bit less of that.
You know what's so great about this mother character is that she was so relatable, and then kind of with these edges of craziness, you know, that you thought, I know this woman, I have these thoughts, I think like this. And then she'd say something that's, you know, just so slightly off kilter. You're like, I think she's crazy, but I think I'm kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That was one of the, that's what I was hoping to evoke.
Right, right. Yeah. And this lovely line of making somebody, you know, just crazy enough that you're not going to lose sympathy with them, but that you're intrigued by them and you know, you're still rooting for them, but you're a little scared of them at the same time.
Thank you. Thanks.
Were there people in here or things in here that gave you a particularly difficult time, and how did you massage your way through them?
Well, I hate to keep making it sound like it was so easy, but I think that there weren't. In all my, except with one exception, my first novel, Suspicious River, that one just, you know, kind of revealed itself to me during the process of writing it. Everything, all the other novels, there was something, someone who had to go or be changed radically in order for me to be able to revise the novel or go back and start over again. This one, that just wasn't the case.
It's every writer's dream, I'm telling
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I know, it sounds like I'm bragging.
No.
It'll never happen to me again.
Well, just that it happened once, I think is fantastic. My guest this morning is Laura Kaziski. The book is Mind of Winter. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Mind of Winter, we should say, is the line of poetry from a Wallace Stevens poem. And I know poetry is obviously critical to you as poet and perhaps as novelist as well. And this character is in the novel a poet. Talk a little bit about choosing the title. It's a lovely title. And whether did that come as easily as the rest of it?
You know, it kind of did. I think it was there from the beginning. I don't know why, but I must have had that poem on my mind. I mean, it's poetry. I know, and pretty intimately. So, but the image from the Stevens poem and the idea of a kind of zen-like state of mind, but with a bad emptiness, a bad edge of emptiness, and denial, and an attempt to have a perfect world and a, you know, clean house and a trouble-free life all sort of worked together for me. Maybe part of the process of writing the novel, maybe it was a little easier because I already had some of these things pretty clear in my mind, like the title and the poem that inspired some of the novel and its imagery.
Right, right. And certain of the events I think you had talked about happening to you, there's a scene in the book where she cuts herself with a knife. And I know that scene takes place in a poem you wrote and took place in your actual life. And this lovely interplay between, you know, what really happens to you and where that leaves off and where fiction begins.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think because the novel, except in the flashbacks that take place in Siberia and elsewhere, because it's all in a house on a Christmas day, and it's a relationship between a mother and a child, a lot of that, it was very easy to cannibalize my own life for that, because I live in a house, and I had a mother, and I have a child, and so more so maybe than anything else I've written, it was just really easy to follow my own domestic adventures or lack thereof and find meaning in them to insert into this plot.
Right. My guest is Laura Kaziski, the book Mind of Winter. I know as a poet that you have an incredible attention to word choice and language and the appearance of words on the page. And you break a lot of rules really elegantly. You know, there's always this rule that you hear in the back of your head. Don't use any exclamation points, or, you know, a novel can only handle one exclamation point. And this novel uses it liberally, but I think to great effect, because it shows that she's kind of unraveling, and, you know, it's you use punctuation in a wonderful state way to show her mental state, and italics. You italicize a lot of words as I was going through it. I think also to show her mental state. How conscious is that, or how much consideration do you give to not just to word choice, but also to other elements on the page, punctuation, style of writing and whatnot?
Well, when I'm first drafting, I pay no attention to it whatsoever. When I'm just, you know, trying to get a beginning and middle and end on the page, I don't think about word order and I don't think about the punctuation. I just follow whatever my inclinations are. But then when I revise, I kind of revise in passes. So I, you know, punctuation and word order and word choice and syntax and italics and all that sort of thing, you know, that a great deal of time goes into making decisions or revising decisions. But sometimes less than others, because I find, you know, if I'm in the right state and have the right sort of, tone going at some point when I'm first drafting, it's a lot of times it appears on the page the way I think, you know, intuitively it was meant to. So there's less pulling of teeth later on.
Yep, that makes sense. You, I want to talk a little bit about your notebooks, because they sound important to your writing process. So you keep a notebook with you at all times and jot down little bits in it by what I've read. And what I really loved, I read something about how you close your notebook and hope the little writing bits mate with each other.
Actually, that's an interview. It's a quote from an interview that I read with the novelist and short story writer Dan Shaun. His last name is spelled Chaon, and he said that he was asked about his writing process, and he said, you know, he'll jot down a scene, and then, you know, the next day I'm sure I'm not doing justice to his quotation here, but the next day he'll, you know, do a character sketch and then some dialogue the next day, and then he'll put them together in a file and close the drawer and hope that they will mate. So I feel like I do something similar to that. So when I read that, I thought, oh, that explains what I do.
I love that. I know that sometimes people have a hard time writing out of order, you know, the natural inclination is to write a bit of dialogue because, you know, it feels easy today and you're trying to avoid some other scene. And then you just have, you know, 700 pages of fragments all over the place.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, to be honest, even though now I've just used the Dan Shaun strategy to describe something I feel like I do, I do have a notebook for that, but a lot of times the whatever it is that's in the notebook never makes its way into a draft of a novel, because I am pretty linear about that. I mean, it doesn't always happen this way when I'm writing novels, but I try to get a beginning, middle, and an end down before I go back, and even, you know, in not with this novel, but in the course of other drafting of other novels, you know, characters' names will change as I'm writing, or their ages or where they live, but I won't go back and revise. I'll just keep going until I figure out what it is I'm writing and what this character's name should be and what the weather should be, and sometimes that changes in the course of a draft. So I am, at the same time that I would say that I'll write in bits and pieces, that actually may be more of my poetry writing strategy than my novel writing strategy.
Do you write poetry while you're working on the novel, or are they totally separate in your head?
Well, they're totally separate in my head, but I do it at the same time. But
okay.
It's not that any poetry I'm writing will inspire things in the novel. Actually, that's not entirely true, but to me, the writing of poetry and the writing of fiction are really, really different, just different parts of the brain or something.
Right. We're lucky in the second half hour, we have Michael Miller in the studio with us, who is a poet. And so I wanted to spend the last little bit of our time together talking a little bit about poetry. And I was talking with him before the show about how many writers say, oh, I can't write poetry. I can't even read poetry. It's just so inaccessible or scary or above me or above, you know. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your feeling of the work of poetry, the goal of poetry, what makes an effective poem. And, you know, and why it continues to be so important in this incredibly rushed world of ours.
Well, the thing that I love about poetry and that I go to poetry for, even when there are other great things happening in a poem, ideas and the music of the language, I look for metaphor. And I don't really know how people approach the world if they don't think in metaphor, and I think most people do and are really attracted to that, are really interested in imagery and how the things in the world either evoke or represent or suggest aspects of the human condition that can only really be thought about in terms of the stuff in the world. And so I think that people do love poetry, just that maybe they're not finding the right poetry. I think that for me, what even when I'm reading fiction, what I'm looking for is a way to experience something in the natural world as it connects with an emotional experience or a philosophical idea that can't even really be expressed in words, but that we all share. So I blame poets for not bringing that more to, and also the teachers of poetry for not, revealing to people early on what it is that they're already really attracted to that is poetry, and which you can find in poems, but we find in the world too.
Right. It is so often an image in a poem that ends up speaking to you, or the words doing something with sound or some organization on the page that, you know, the way it looks on the page that's communicating something at a deeper subconscious level than the individual words themselves.
Right, and of course, you know, so much time is spent in literature courses explicating and figuring out exactly what something means that a lot of times people go to poetry with the idea that, they have to figure out what it means instead of just sense what it means, and that kind of ruins the experience. And, you know, no wonder they balk at the idea of sitting down with poems. They've been taught that they can't understand them.
Right. Yeah, they do. There's a way that you feel particularly stupid or uneducated or something when you're in the presence of a poem that you feel like, you know, I'm just too dense to understand it or something.
Right. Well, it's also, I mean, it's language and it's our language, and so it's harder to let go of the idea that language doesn't always translate into some sort of literal meaning. Most people have no problem whatsoever letting that part of their minds go when they're listening to music, but when it comes to language, I think it's not that you need to be taught how to let that go, but you need to be given license or permission, or shown what that permission can lead to.
You're reflecting a lot of the things he said before the show. Michael said before the show. That's funny. Great poets' minds think alike. I think.
Well,
fantastic. Do your notebooks for poetry look similar to your notebooks for your novel? You know, in your poetry notebooks, I don't know if you have poetry notebooks, but do you just kind of jot down a word that turns into something else, so that looks
and lines and
I love that you can do both of the, you know, it seems like people are essentially poets or essentially novelists. And, you know, sometimes somebody dips into a short story world when they get, sort of desperate to, I don't know what. it's amazing that you have these two parts of your brain that work, you know, independently and so well, firing on all cylinders at the same time. That strikes me as unusual.
Well, thank you for saying that.
We're drawing down on our time. I've been with Laura Kaziski, the novel Mind of Winter. Where do we find you on? Where do we find you online and in the world? You're probably going to be headed out on a big giant book tour, I would imagine.
Well, I don't know about that. It's a pretty busy time of my semester, so I'm not going to be traveling a whole lot. But I have a website which I need to update. Maybe I'll be inspired now that I'm telling you about it to get on the web and update it. LauraKaziski.com.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I'm going to spell your last name for people because it's easier to find that. So it's all LauraKaziski, one word, .com.
Yeah.
Kaziski, we should say, is KASISCHKE, LauraKaziski.com. Any last minute words of writing advice that we didn't cover?
Well, for people who are writing or want to write, I think the best you can do is just read a lot. Everyone always says that, but it's true. And write every day, even if what you're writing is, only going to mean anything to you. I always feel like the difference between myself writing a lot and people who don't but who want to is that I'm not a perfectionist. I just, I put things down on the page and I just figure I can deal with it later.
So, excellent advice.
Doesn't have to be good.
Excellent advice. Laura Kaziski, thanks so much for taking the time this morning.
Well,
congratulations.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Poet Michael Miller will be here for the second half hour, literally in the studio with me, which is so rarely happens, an enormous treat. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this
darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us at iTunes. We are under College Radio. Or you can also visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. There you can find direct downloads to past shows, upcoming shows, information, speaker series events, and more. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Michael Miller, a native of Fullerton, California. Michael is the author of two books of poetry and a longtime reporter and editor for the LA Times organization. He holds a master's degree in creative writing from the University of East Anglia and has taught at Golden West College and lectured at Chapman University, Cal State Fullerton, Concordia University, and the Orange County School of the Arts. As an owner of Moontide Press, he has published nearly two dozen books and organizes the poetry series at the Muckenthaler, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Cultural Center. His first full-length collection of poems, College Town, came out from T. Both Bach in 2010. His second, The First Thing Mastered, followed from the same publisher in 2013. He served as a judge for Poetry Out Loud and the San Diego Book Awards, and his work has appeared in San Pedro River Review, Rockhurst Review, Fault Line, Lemmix, Pea River Journal, and elsewhere. It is his latest collection, or the First Thing Mastered, that we'll be talking about this morning. Michael, hi.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be on the air.
I love having you in the studio. I should do this more often.
Thank you. Well, you know, I'm an anteater myself, class of 2002, so I'll use any excuse I can to visit campus again.
Well, we love to have you. So I'm going to let you talk about the collection, what inspired this collection, and kind of how it came together for you.
What inspired the collection? Well, I think what inspired the collection is life itself. This is a thematic collection of poems about the formative years of life. It's broken into four sections. The first section is about childhood. The second is about adolescence. Section three is about young adulthood. And then section four kind of goes to the beginning of middle age. So, there's the ancient cliche, write what you know. And that really is what I did in this case.
Now, did you know that all the way along? Did you set out to write this as a collection and then kind of order it that way?
The overall thrust of the book kind of came during the process. You know, obviously I was aiming to write a full collection after my first book. But in terms of finding the overall theme, it was kind of a difficult process at first. The previous guest here, Laura, she was talking about writing a bunch of stuff in her notebook, and then, you know, kind of out of all these various parts, you end up, you know, determining what the whole is going to be. And so about 2.5 years ago, I was kind of just sitting there and writing anything and everything. I had, you know, poems that probably could have fit in five different collections if they'd all been brought out to fruition. But at one point in doing all that, I wrote a poem. It's a poem called The Pool Coach Sings Hallelujah, which is in the last section of the book. And it's a poem about a man who's new to being a high school pool coach and just feeling very, very anxious about doing the job. And I liked that one, so I set it aside. And then a little bit after that one, I wrote one called 4.5, which is about the world seen from a very young boy's point of view. And I was thinking of both of those as individual poems at the time, you know, not really parts of a collection. But then I sat down and looked at them both, and I realized these are both poems that just address very specific phases in life. You know, you start out as a 4-year-old boy, and then 20-some years later, you may be that pool coach who's supposed to keep all the boys in line now as part of your new job. And so that got me thinking more about the actual phases of life, just kind of these settings that recur from, you know, from time to time. And that was when the sort of the chronological idea of the book really came about.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. You know, you should read them to us. Do you want to read them?
Oh, absolutely.
I'd love that.
Should I do it chronologically?
Yeah, I was thinking, yeah, maybe you should. I think that makes sense, right?
Okay. So the first one here is called 4.5. And this is a poem in four sections. So, section one. The shell is God, and God is in his pocket. Pale blue ridges dotted with sand that he cups a hand on running back from the beach. He hides the shell, though he knows he did not steal it. When he knelt over the rocks, the tide washed it to him. This small blessing delivered like a flake of sky. Ahead, his mother hurries, one step of hers matching five of his. If he falls, the shell will shatter. He locks his fingers, stays upright. 2. She took him to see God the month before. In church, he wailed just to wail, the heads in the rows ahead of him turning in a ripple, smiling, then back around. She apologized for him and hoisted him up, past the pocked stucco walls and the doorman who made the cross above him. Outside, red and crying, she strode to the top of the bluff, then wrapped her arms tighter, chin by his, breathing hard as they stared at the blue. "This," she told him, "this is what we can't escape." 3. "What is heaven like?" he asks them doggedly. The last answer given never satisfies. They say heaven is an ocean without the water, an air without gravity, a height above the clouds. They call it infinity, but it is only higher. Does heaven have a ceiling? Can the ocean roll without its shore? Even the church, where they bow their heads, is a house like all the others. 4. He has a sister now, and they swathe her in pink. God's other color, his mother explains. Pink like the roses and the sweet medicine, her long silk robe, the blush along her skin. At its best, at its clearest, the world codes itself like this: red for the devil, the alarms and stoplights; green for life, the yard after winter. At the pool, he hears, a man drowned in the deep end. "Long ago," they repeat. They nudge him toward the blue. He lowers himself in, the red floater at hand. The red fingernails coax him closer. This is safety now, God always hiding, even in the devil's hue.
You read that very well.
Thank you.
That was unbelievable. 4.5 was that. So that comes in the first section of Childhood. And then a pool coach sings Hallelujahs in the fourth section of the book Home.
Right? Okay. The pool coach sings Hallelujah. Only during the solo drives does he marvel at the things done correctly. At 5 each morning, sparked by caffeine and perched in uniform behind the wheel, he cues the gospel station and cruises through the sleeping city, Aretha and the Nightingales overpowering his reedy tenor as the shapes of buildings rise under the sprawl of constellations. Here, nothing shows but the majesties, the steeple that juts to meet the purple-black dawn, the refinery towers that the plaque on the library says built this county out of dirt and grime. With sunrise come the imperfections. The sophomore is pregnant again, the candles from the last drive-by melted by the porch a mile from campus. In his dreams, some nights, he watches the coach's outlines saunter without him around the pool, the staccato hand against the clipboard turning temper into music, the legs ambling, then snapping to strides to keep the boys at attention. He is the placeholder this fall, shorter than the one from spring. His voice is too high, his shoulders low. But at freshman practice, he spots the hungry looks. The trust in him, the quiet ones, beam sideways across the deck. Between the swears and towel snaps, they seek his assurance, his veteran's guile. They plead to know how to harness precision, to tame the water and rise.
That was beautiful. That was Michael Miller reading from his collection, The First Thing Mastered, that poem, The Pool Coach Sings Hallelujah. So you thought of the 4.5-year-old boy as the man in the pool house sings Hallelujah?
Not necessarily. One thing about this book, there isn't a single name given to any of the characters. I thought if I started labeling them, you know, Jim, Mary, Gabriel, and so on, it would be a little bit too grounded. So I kind of see this as the story of every man. Mm-hmm. If you follow the different poems, some of them clearly take place in different settings, different parts of the world. So I wanted to keep it a little bit floating in that sense. Kind of they're all different and they're all the same, which is why I went without any actual names for people. But it's funny you mention about a prequel to The Pool Coach Sings Hallelujah. There is actually a prequel to that poem in Section 2. It's a poem called Slowest Member on the Junior Varsity. And this is a poem about the same setting. It's a high school swim team. Only in this case, it's told from a student's point of view. You have this student, you know, looking up at a very tough kind of a militaristic coach. And then later on, you have this other one, the pool coach sings Hallelujah. And, the pool coach in that poem, he may be the student who's, you know, just trying to make it around the pool in the earlier poem. It could be the 4.5-year-old boy. So kind of a lot of these, it's kind of anywhere you want to connect the dots, really. I wanted to leave that open to the reader to be able to do it.
Right. It's so nice. There are a lot of seashells in your work, and we were talking in the first half hour about the importance of imagery and metaphor, and how a lot of these images sort of speak to a part of your subconscious soul, maybe, that and in the pool coach sings Hallelujah, I was hooked onto the candle wax that was melted onto the porch after the last drive-by. And these images that, like I say, are sort of in conversation with some other part of your subconscious soul. Mm-hmm. There are a handful of them that keep repeating. Tell me a little bit about evocative images that speak to you, trying to find the right metaphoric images that speak to you. Maybe this is sort of too difficult of a question to answer, but
oh, not at all.
A little bit about that.
Yeah, there are definitely a few motifs that go throughout the book. One of them is water, like you mentioned, and that's on the cover as well. Mm. And water here, see if I can explain it as best I can. Water kind of represents what we can navigate, but we can't control. It's like you have both the pool coach and the boys in the pool. There's imagery of swimming, of trying not to drown. In other words, when you're there in the water, you can swim or you can sink, but you can't get rid of the water. You can't control the waves. So kind of navigating the water is like navigating life in a way. Mm. So water is a very constant image. Wine is an image throughout the book, too. There's a poem early on called The Glass, which is about a group of young boys kind of, they're being given wine by an indulgent grown-up during a 4th of July party. And then wine continues throughout. It's kind of like the forbidden fruit, sort of what we're not technically allowed to have, but we desire. Spiders appear a few times. Spiders represent danger. And there's a poem very early in Section 1 where a boy gets spanked for trying to touch a spider. And then the second-to-last poem in Section 4 about an expectant father, and then you have him, you know, walking around his home and making sure that all the spiders are gone, you know, preparing for his own child to make sure his child will be safe. And there's a couple others too. There are two words that recur once in each of the four sections of the book, and those are prize and kingdom. And in each case, they mean a different thing. The second poem in the book actually is called Prize, and it's about a figurine, this little statue of a blue angel that a boy wants to touch. And so the prize is kind of, it's what we desire but we don't have. The other word is kingdom. Kingdom is whatever we preside over, however good or bad it is, kind of what the domain is that we have at the moment. And so in each of the four sections, the word prize and the word kingdom are each used once. And you can kind of track it to see at these different phases in life, you know, what is the kingdom and what is the prize too.
Love that. It's funny because there are certain images or things that happen, like the spider is a great example of, you know, maybe I don't have a particular fear of spiders, but I can connect with it in this very human, or wine, I can connect with it in this very visceral, human, primordial way that even if I don't have a direct experience with it, it speaks to something in me. And I was thinking about those, I can't remember what they were called, but you remember those images from the 1980s where if you unfocused your eyes and you stared at this picture, you could make out the spaceship or whatever it was, but it was just a series of of computer dots.
The magic eye was
yeah,
that
the
what
magic
they called
eye.
Those magic
right.
eye. Yeah.
Right. And I, you know, I was thinking that's sort of how poetry works, that if you unfocus your eyes and you kind of let your guard down and you open up your soul to it, it speaks to some other part of your brain or some other part of your body that that kind of allows you to connect with it in a nod, but you can't read it literally. Mm-hmm. It's tough to read literally.
That's absolutely true. I mean, once in a while, I'll even have somebody talk about a poem I've written, and they'll say, you know, oh, I noticed this hidden image or something, or I interpreted the poem this way. And I'll realize, I mean, that's not even what I had in mind. But then when I read it again, I can see what they mean. I can see where you could get that interpretation out of it. So absolutely, it's one of my favorite things about poetry.
Yeah, yeah. We were talking before the show about people's fear of poetry mm-hmm. and maybe them just not finding the right poetry. But mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about encouraging people to get over their fear of reading poetry. And I don't know if they should get over their fear of writing it, because not everybody should be writing poetry. But mm-hmm. but how to read poetry to, you know, to get the most out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when I hear people ask the question, do you like poetry? I mean, to me, that's like, do you like music? You know, do you like movies? Well, you know, all music, every movie ever made. You know, there are so many different styles of poetry, just the same with music or film or anything else. So I think when people say that they don't like poetry or they don't get it, what I take that to mean is that probably they had to study it in school and it wasn't their favorite subject. Maybe in college English, they got some really obscure academic poems that they had a hard time figuring out. And so they're kind of looking at those and seeing the entire genre of poetry right there. Mm. But, you know, you can take 10 books by very renowned poets and really have almost nothing in common among the 10 of them. There's so many approaches to poetry. Some of it is very obscure. Some of it is, you know, very accessible. There are people like, Mary Oliver. I know I think she's promoted as America's best-selling poet. Mary Oliver is one of the people that I'd recommend to someone who's a little on the fence about poetry. They're a little bit worried that they're not going to understand it. She's very accessible. She uses a lot of natural imagery, so she's very kind of visual with a lot of her work. So Mary Oliver is one I can certainly recommend, and Charles Bukowski, I think, is one of the few poets who really has a following even among non-poetry types. You know, he has, again, just that very direct conversational style to a lot of his work. And so I think Bukowski is one who really resonates with a lot of people who normally think that they don't like poetry.
We need like a Shel Silverstein for adults. Right?
I think Ogden Nash may have come close to that.
Yeah, right, so. Right. My guest this morning in studio with me is Michael Miller. The collection of poetry is The First Thing Mastered. What are there things that you can tell that make a successful poem? And when you read bad poetry, can you say this is why it failed or this is why this poem succeeded?
Oh, it's almost easier for me to make that judgment on my own work than somebody else's. Because, you know, again, if I'm reading another poet and I'm thinking this isn't a successful poem, that might just mean that it doesn't appeal to me personally. I think the word successful there is key. I mean, if it's what the poet had in mind, then it is a success, regardless of what someone else's opinion may be. In terms of rating my own work, you know, there's a story about Picasso that I love. According to this legend, one time, an art dealer came to Picasso and said, I've been given a lot of paintings over the years that people said were Picasso's. Can you go through and tell me which ones are real and which ones are forgeries? And so Picasso's going through the pile, he's putting it in the real and the fake stacks, and then at one point he puts a painting in the fake stack, and the dealer says, wait a minute, Pablo, that's not a forgery. I was visiting you the weekend you painted that. And Picasso just says, no matter, I can fake a Picasso as well as any thief in Europe. So in terms of my own work, I can kind of tell if I'm faking a Michael Miller poem. For this book, now there are 44 poems in this collection, and I would say I probably spiked at least 20 of them along the way. I'm very brutal with myself as an editor, and that's always kind of my standard. If I look at a poem, and even if technically there's nothing wrong with it, I can tell when I'm faking it and when I'm really writing something sincerely. And so the ones that I let go, they were ones that were just, they were kind of artificial in a way, they were kind of mannered, they were maybe sort of reiterating something that I'd done previously. Mm. And so I know a poem is successful when, you know, it passes that test when I can tell that it's not fake. And basically, if I can go from the first word to the last word, read it out loud, and nothing in it makes me wince, then I know that it's good to go.
I wonder if it's the same concept as digging deep for a novelist, where you say the novelist didn't go into the dark enough place or was shying away from something. I wonder if it's a similar, I don't know, if there's a correlation there.
It could be, yeah. I mean, they always talk about form and content. I think content always has to come first. If you start focusing on form, that's when you're going to be writing one of those kind of fake poems in one way or another. You have to really start with the bare... What word did I use a minute ago? The form and content. Thank
content,
you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need to start with just the raw content. You know, do your free writing, whatever it needs to be to really get that on the page. And then when you've gotten that down, when you know you have the content, that's when you can start shaping it one way or another. But I found that personally, like if I sit down and say I want the poem to be, you know, X number of lines long, and I want it to end on this image, that's when I find I start really straining too hard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. The ones that I connect to are emotionally resonant, mm-hmm. that you feel, you know, somehow connected in the human condition to somebody else and say, I had that fear, or I had that response, or, you know, the spider coming out of the crack in the wall with this dangerous man in the house. And, you know, we all can all connect to that. Right? I don't know. That's, for me, strikes me as when I'm reading poetry, sort of the most successful poems make me feel a little less alone, maybe, in the world. Or, you know, that, oh, somebody else had that thought, too.
That's what you always hope for. You always hope for that kindred spirit out there.
Right. I want, before we draw down on our time, which we are, I wanted to talk a little bit about Moontide Press and your work in editing, what you look for when you're editing versus what you look for when you're writing, and if your editor side helps or hurts your writer side.
My editor side, I think the two of them, they definitely play off of each other. In terms of looking at a manuscript, I want every poem to be strong, of course, but I like to see a flow, too. There's some collections where every piece just kind of follows the one before. Like, together, it adds up to something that's greater than just the sum of its parts. And so, the books that we accept, they're generally ones where, again, there's a lot of great individual poems. I know they don't talk about singles in poetry the way they do in music, but we like singles. We like, you know, the ones that can be run on their own in a magazine. They can be, you know, read at a coffee house or read on the air. But we like to see the collection as a whole, too, just something that really holds together and resonates from beginning to end.
Right. I like that. Mm-hmm. And do you find that you're hypercritical of your own work now that you're editing other people's?
I think I'd be hypercritical of my own work regardless. But yeah, I think Laura, our last guest, was talking about that, too. If you want to strengthen your own writing, you really just have to read a lot. And I think it's having read so many manuscripts, having edited so many over the years, you do find yourself assimilating a lot of different voices. And I mean, I can say for sure I'm a much better poet now than I was before I started Moontide Press. Mm. And more than anything, it's just because of all that experience reading other styles, just seeing how different poets approach the same topics.
Right.
You just realize how many more tools you have at your disposal then.
Right. Oh, man. 9:57. How rude. We've drawn down on our time. Is there writing advice that we should have talked about that we didn't talk about?
Oh, writing advice that we should talk about. I would say, you know, in addition to reading other people's work, just have fun with your own. I think one definite rule of writing is that if your work is tedious to you, it's going to be tedious to the reader as well. Mm. And so whenever I'm in the middle of writing something and I'm just really not enjoying it, that's the sign to me that it probably isn't going to resonate with the reader either. And that's where I'll find a twist, find some way to make it a little bit more lively. And that's when I get back in a groove again.
I love it. Thank you, Michael Miller, for coming on.
You're welcome. Glad to be back.
Where do we find you can we find you online?
Oh, you can visit Moontide at www.moontidepress.com. And I do want to give a shout out to my publisher, Tabat Bach. They're a terrific nonprofit press that's based here in Orange County. And Tabat Bach, that's Welsh for Little Teapot. And so you'll want to go to www.tebotbach.org.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Michael Miller.
Oh, thank you, Marie.
That was Michael Miller. The collection is The First Thing Mastered. You can find it and buy it. It was absolutely wonderful. That is all the time we have for today. Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, stay tuned for a little reggae coming up next with Teddy. And we'll see you right back here next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.